Roxo Media House.
A Signal 51 is police code for an investigation, a law enforcement proceeding that is a systemic and thorough attempt to learn the facts about a possible crime that is complex and whose facts and circumstances are generally hidden, at least initially, behind obstacles that can be coincidental and or man-made. Investigations methods are formal. I'm John Henry, a journalist. My partner is Jake White, a retired Fort Worth police sergeant. And together, we examine the difficult cases of law enforcement, both in Fort Worth and around the region. This is Signal 51. The show is designed specifically for a more mature audience. Some of the content is graphic and is not intended for younger audiences. In 2016, Nicole Blahitka was one of 13 women murdered in Tarrant County related to domestic violence. At the close of 2020, most recent statistics available, 17 women in Tarrant County had been murdered related to domestic violence. If you are in an abusive relationship, get help. Go to police, a women's shelter, family, church, or any refuge. Today's episode, The Last Murder of 2016. Christmas time in North Texas can be a schizoid time weather-wise. It could be 32 degrees with a wind chill of 5, or it could be 80, or it could be something in between. It could also be all three of those things. But in 2016, 5 days after Christmas Day, was nice. It was a cool day in Fort Worth, Texas, with a temperature reading 57 degrees under partly cloudy skies. The holidays were still very much in the air. The anticipation of a new day that comes with every new year was at its highest point as New Year's Eve partygoers purchased their booze and readied for the festivities, as they do every year. A new beginning. At 12:30 p.m. on December 30th, Fort Worth police officers received a 911 call in the 3600 block of Middlewood Drive. The call, a Signal 51. When police arrived, they were told the body of an adult female was lying in her bed upstairs, unresponsive and in a pool of blood, a condition that police quickly confirmed. Medics who followed minutes behind determined that Nicole Nikki Blahitka was deceased. The homicide was the last murder in 2016 in Fort Worth, Texas.
911?
This is 911. How can I help you?
My mother is in bed and she's not moving.
What's the address?
There's blood in her ear.
What's the address?
Middlewood Drive.
Middlewood Drive?
Yes.
Is that a house, apartment, or a duplex?
No, it's a house.
Okay, and what's your name? What is it? What's your phone number?
817. 817. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm going to connect you with the ambulance. Do not hang up.
Miss, what is the address of the emergency?
Oh, I already got hooked up. Middlewood Drive.
Is that a house, an apartment, or a business?
The house.
What's the phone number you're calling me from in case I have to call you back?
817.
Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
Mommy.
Tell me what happened.
She's bleeding, and I don't know. I just got home from my dad's house, and she's bleeding on her neck, and there's blood on her ears.
Okay, all right. We're going to help her, okay? I just need you to stay calm so we can do everything we can for your mom, okay?
Okay.
What's your mom's name?
Nikki Blahitka.
Okay. I need you to take a deep breath because I can't understand you because you're crying. One more time.
Nikki Blahitka.
Say that last name one more time.
Blahitka.
Can you spell that for me, please?
B-L-A-H-I-T-K-A.
Okay. And you said Nikki was your first name?
Yes.
Is it N-I-C-K-I?
N-I-K-K-I.
K-K-I, okay. All right, now we're going to help her, okay? How old is your mommy?
She's 49.
Okay. Is she awake?
No, her heart's not beating.
I'm sorry?
Her heart isn't beating. Oh, no. Okay. Oh, God, there's something on her arm. Someone attacked her.
Listen. listen to me, okay, so we can help her. I understand what you said about her heart, but is she breathing?
No.
Okay, is your front door unlocked?
I will go and lock it now.
Okay, run and do that and then come right back to her, okay?
Okay. What happened? Lord, no.
Now, while you do that, is there a defibrillator available?
No.
Okay. Tell me when you're back with her, okay? We're going to help her until someone gets there.
I just unlocked the door.
Okay, unlock the door and run back to her. How old are you?
I'm 12 years old.
12? What's your name? Okay. Run back to your mommy now.
I'm with her.
I'm sorry?
I'm with her.
Okay. Okay, listen carefully, okay? I need you to lay her flat on her back on the ground and remove any pillows.
Okay.
Tell me when that's done. Is she flat on her back now? Put me on speakerphone. Put me on speakerphone.
Okay.
Okay. Is she flat on her? Is she flat on her back?
I can't carry her.
I mean, you don't have to carry her. What? Where is she? What position is she in? Where is she right now?
She's in her bed.
Okay. Is she flat on her back?
Oh, she's like stiff.
What's that?
She's stiff.
She's stiff?
No, I can't.
Sadly, that call is what initiated the 66th and final murder in the city of Fort Worth for the year 2016. Clearly, 66 murders is 66 too many. But sadly, it's only a problem getting worse in our fine city. Year after year, the murder rate has climbed, and when 2021 closed out, there were 121 murders in Fort Worth, almost doubled in a five-year period. This case was full of mystery and intrigue that most did not have in 2016. Often, when society visualizes a murder scene, or when Hollywood portrays a murder scene, it is more often than not in a dark alley, or a drug-infested house, or in some gang territory, or in the middle of a street, and the list goes on. Where most murders are not, though, they're not usually in an affluent neighborhood and behind the closed doors of a house worth over $1.5 million. This house on Middlewood Drive was in a relatively new neighborhood in southwest Fort Worth. It sits just blocks off the Chisholm Trail Tollway and is chocked full of wealth, not crime. In fact, in 2016, police had responded to only two calls on Middlewood Drive and only a handful more in the large neighborhood. Bottom line, crime was not and is not much of a problem in the affluent subdivision. More about the intrigue, the call details. We know based on that 911 call, a female in her 40s was lifeless and had blood coming from her ear.
Jake, before you retired, you were in with the department for 22 years, more than 22 years, right?
22, yep.
How many homicides did you respond to in your career? And did you work this case?
Did not work this case. In regards to how many, I don't have a number. Many in relation to the vast majority of my time was in an undercover assignment. So we weren't the ones responding to most 911 calls, but overall I responded to many.
So the first officers respond to the scene. What steps are generally taken? What's the protocol for those first responders?
So it depends on the circumstances. In this case, you and I found no evidence that the scene was chaos or chaotic. We learned the child and housekeeper were there. I would assume in this case, medical personnel were the first on scene because it always seems like they beat the cops there. They're typically always the first ones to arrive unless a cop just so happens to be right down the street, but that's seldom the case. So in this house, again, we're talking about an affluent neighborhood. We're talking about a house that, you know, all of the houses in the neighborhood are $1+ million, even in 2016. They're probably double that now. So what this scene probably lacked was chaos in the streets. Like I mentioned before, a lot of murder scenes, especially if they're in a high crime area, an area that's sadly subjected to violent crime, when the officers first arrive, there can be 20, 30 people standing in the street. You may have a body laying in the street, or you're going to have pools of blood, etc. This case is different, though, because this scene lacked that chaos. This was more of a call where the officers pull up to, and they know what's behind the closed doors, but they don't have to focus on, I don't want to say they don't have to focus on protecting the crime scene. That's obviously going to be paramount, but they're able to focus on the task at hand, which is initiating the homicide investigation versus trying to deal with an unruly crowd. But in this one, like I said, they walk into the house, and in the bedroom, there's the deceased body of Nikki on the bed. And once they make that observation, or once medical personnel tells them that she's deceased, then the first thing they're going to do is they're going to start the steps to secure the crime scene. With the Hollywood style stuff, in some cases it's the crime scene tape. They're going to start a crime scene log documenting who's going in and out of the house. They're even going to take a quick look around the house, not a search for any type of evidence, but ultimately they're going to look to make sure that there's nobody else that's in the house that's been injured or harmed. They're going to look just to, on the slim to none chance that there's no suspect hiding in a closet or hiding under a bed or something like that. Again, it's not a search for evidence, but it is just simply to secure that scene so the detectives, when they arrive, can safely process the evidence.
So, can police actually make a determination that one is deceased, or does that have to be done by a medic or medical examiner?
Now, that determination is always made by a medic or the medical examiner. In this case, I believe it was just the medical personnel that were on scene, so the paramedics that were there.
So you mentioned the detectives. Mm-hmm. Always play, obviously, the key role in solving these crimes. Tell me a little bit about homicide detectives.
So I'm going to throw this disclaimer out. I was always a bit envious of these guys. These homicide detectives, they're like the A-team of detectives in Fort Worth. They're the best of the best. They leave no stone unturned. They are very driven and will not stop until they catch the perpetrator. In real life, it really does remind me of the show The First 48. They show up, usually wearing a suit or at least a shirt and tie. They're tenacious. They're thorough. They're always cooler than the other side of the pillow. Nothing ever seems to get them ruffled. No matter if it's four bodies, covered in blood or a chaotic crime scene, they always seem to have the same demeanor, which is super calm. The detectives in this case, they're highly trained, but what really sets them apart, though, is their experience. In Fort Worth, and I'm sure in other large cities, homicide detectives, they're not some rookie cop or even a rookie detective. These guys have put the work in, they deserve to be where they are, and they probably have no plans on climbing the corporate ladder. I think the other comparison I would make, these guys are the real-life Jimmy McNulty or Bunk Morlands for the Wire fans that are listening. Mm. These guys have mastered the crafts from interrogation to writing detailed reports, and these guys solve murders. The clearance rate in Fort Worth is high, the clearance rate meaning the murder solved. So long story short, if you decide to kill someone in Fort Worth, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get caught.
You mentioned The First 48. I think a lot of our listeners know what that is, but what is the key to the first 48 hours of a murder?
I think the easiest way to summarize that is gathering as much intelligence or as much information about the crime and seeking to apprehend the suspect quickly. Obviously, the more time passes, the more time the suspect can flee, the more time the suspect can conceal his tracks. So getting on to them in a short time frame, like 48 hours, is important.
And these homicide detectives in Fort Worth jumped on this case immediately, and as we will see, spent almost all the next 2 days working on this case.
Yeah, that definitely, we looked at Detective Pate's case notes, and that was one of the things that stood out was the time. There was one entry where he concluded at the crime scene the night of the murder at 4:15 a.m., presuming he has a 5, 10, 20, 30-minute drive home, goes to sleep, but he's back at work at 10:15 the next morning. Right. So it is around the clock. I mean, the tenacity that I've seen from these guys specifically and other detectives, it's hard to rival.
It's a dogged pursuit for sure. Much like that linebacker going after the quarterback.
That's exactly right.
And on the day of the 30th at 2:20, Detective Pate arrived at the scene. He was assisted by homicide detective Cedillo and Anderson. A medic had pronounced Nikki dead at 12:37 p.m. Pate noted in his report that the deceased had what appeared to be a gunshot wound to the head. There was no firearm nearby, and the wound did not appear to be self-inflicted. Dr. Rowe of the Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Office would ultimately positively identify the victim as Nicole Blahitka. An autopsy would confirm Pate's observations. Her cause of death was a gunshot to the head, and the manner of death was a homicide. Jake, what else did they find when they arrived at the house on Middlewood?
So when the responding officers got there, well, I don't know, they had two cooperating witnesses. Unfortunately, the son was there and had some information that's going to turn out to be relevant later, and the housekeeper was there. According to the arrest warrant affidavit, the detective spoke with the housekeeper on scene. She told them that she had worked for Nikki, and when she, the housekeeper, arrived at the house shortly before 11 a.m., she saw Nikki's car parked at the house and the blinds were still drawn. While it was unusual for Nikki to still be home at that time of the day, the housekeeper did not think anything was out of the ordinary. It was the week between Christmas and New Year's, after all. The housekeeper had a key and let herself in. When she entered the home, though, she noticed a highball glass, a bottle of wine, and wine glasses in what was described as the great room and also in the kitchen. And I think as a side note, just that term great room gives you an idea of what kind of home we're talking about. Again, to reiterate, the value just on the tax rolls was over $1 million, $1.5 million. Detective Pate, later in one of the interviews that we'll later play or that we'll have uploaded on the website, tells, or in one of the conversations that he's having, it's the biggest house he's ever been into.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge house. It's a massive house. Like I said, this is not a neighborhood that has crime problems. This is not a neighborhood where this kind of activity happens often. I mean, I think the easiest way to put it is it's an affluent neighborhood, and most people who live there are very wealthy, much like Nikki was.
So the housekeeper, her initial impression is that there might have been a party the night before, and her boss was merely sleeping in and maybe off the effects of a late night. The housekeeper tells detectives that she also noticed throw pillows on the floor and gray panties on the couch.
Yeah, I can only assume these observations were out of the ordinary because she mentioned them to detectives. If it was the commonplace, I don't know that that's something that she would have brought up or something that she would have highlighted. I mean, obviously, there was something to that that stood out to her. On the surface, just discussing it, does it sound strange? Absolutely. And clearly, according to the housekeeper, it was unusual, but it wasn't unusual enough for her to not start her tasks at hand. So she went about her business and started to clean a few rooms before she got to Nikki's bedroom. When she opened the door to Nikki's bedroom, she noticed Nikki was lying in bed. She was lying on her right side, her back to the door, and also her back to the housekeeper's view. Again, just thinking she was asleep and not wanting to disturb her, the housekeeper closed the doors and closed the door and continued cleaning elsewhere.
So around noon, the housekeeper told detectives Nikki's 12-year-old son arrived at the house. He had spent the night with his father, Nikki's ex-husband, Mark Blahitka. The boy ran up to his mother's room and jumped on the bed trying to wake her, shaking her as enthused children might do with parents they miss. Tragically, the young boy makes a gruesome discovery that something is indeed terribly wrong. The housekeeper calls the husband, Mark, while the boy makes his very brave call to 911. Jake, husbands and ex-husbands and intimates are always immediately persons of interest in cases like this. Is that not the case?
It is. And I think in large part it comes down to several reasons. You know, when you look at this, maybe it's something related to finances. They're going through the husband and wife are going through some kind of financial woes. Maybe it's related to a life insurance policy, you know, kind of that Hollywood story that you see. Maybe it's just simply related to a desire to separate, and they don't know how to separate on, I guess, the right terms. I don't know how to.
Right. I mean, it's separation is very emotional.
I think that's what it is. I think the emotions come out in it, and for whatever reason, that's the answer, which is baffling, but it does happen. And that's in a lot of cases why they are the suspects. I mean, are considered the suspects. I mean, ultimately there's a lot of reasons. In this case though, at 4 p.m. that same day, the ex-husband and the son were asked to go to police headquarters downtown in downtown Fort Worth, where they met with Detective Pate. The ex-husband also brought his attorney with them. During the interview, both the son and the ex-husband say they believed a man named Josh had a role in this. The son specifically told Detective Pate he thought Josh was involved because his mother had an affair with him and that Josh was, quote, wasn't a nice person. The ex-husband confirmed that Josh and Nikki had met while the Blitkes' house on Middlewood was being constructed. Josh was a carpenter working on the job site. The ex-husband also confirmed that Nikki had an affair with him, which led to a breakup of their marriage. The relationship between his estranged wife and new boyfriend had continued, the ex-husband said, and it was bumpy at times.
Detective Pate returns to the scene of the crime at 6:35 on the 30th. He meets with Nikki's mother, who is there to retrieve items for her grandson. She also has a number for Josh Henry, which she gives the detective. Detective Anderson obtains the security log for the residence that shows which exterior doors are open and closed and gives a timestamp for each event. Pate makes notes from that log on the 29th of December. At 9:54 p.m., someone arrives at the residence and disables the alarm portion of the security system, and the code entered belongs to, quote, Nikki, unquote. 10:49 p.m., the log indicates that there's been a power failure at the house. At 11:09 p.m., the mudroom doors open and then closed. The security log doesn't show any other activity until the next morning when the housekeeper arrives at 10:46. I concluded from this information, Pate wrote in his notes, that it is probable that whoever killed the victim left through the mudroom door at 11:09 p.m. on December 29th, 2016.
Remember, in 2016, technology, and especially home security technology, was not as advanced as it is today. In this case, like you mentioned, Detective Anderson noticed the home was equipped with security cameras and sensors on the doors and windows. The homicide detectives begin to examine the video evidence and notice that at around 9:50 p.m. the previous night, Nikki's car, which was a black Cadillac Escalade, arrived home. A short time later, detectives observed a male emerge from the residence using the front door and go back inside just a few minutes later. The small fact of a person going in and out becomes interesting later. At 10:49 p.m., the detectives found partial power was lost to the house, causing the camera system to become disabled. However, the door sensors continued to function during the power loss. The detective combed through the log of door openings and closures and found at 11:09 p.m., the mudroom door was opened and closed for the last time. So based on this log, homicide detectives believe whoever was responsible for Nikki's death left the house at 11:09 p.m. And I think one thing that's worth noting in this is the quick work is what separates these detectives from just your average detectives. I mean, if you think about it, within a few hours, they had a person of interest identified. They knew when he left. They knew how she was murdered. And now all they had to do was track down Josh Henry. And fortunately, Nikki's family members provided detectives with a phone number for Josh.
Police determined that Joshua Henry is a white male, born January 30th, 1987. Detective Cedillo called Joshua Henry, and he agreed to meet detectives downtown at police headquarters. By 10 minutes after 9 o'clock, Josh Henry sat in front of detectives.
Introduce everybody and say who we are, Marcus. I told you my name's Detective Bates. He's 30, 23. It's my partner, Detective Cedillo, and his ID is...
3014.
Like I said, I appreciate you coming down here. We understand you don't have to be here. You're here voluntarily. You're free to go at any time. And basically, we're just talking to everybody that we can, man.
Yeah,
we're,
sure.
Hoping somebody has some answers that we don't have, you know, and trying to figure out what's going on here. We've been working all day on this. And just talking to everybody that we can, friends, family, trying to get some answers, you know. Hopefully somebody can shed some light on something.
Initially, Josh denied any involvement with Nikki's death, but his story was very suspicious. He told homicide detectives that Nikki had contacted him earlier in the day and told him that she was going to go to a large sporting goods store in far north Fort Worth. Nikki and Josh agreed to go together. At the store, Nikki bought him a few things, and after they left, they continued spending the day together. He stated that they had driven around looking at different sites in and around Fort Worth. While this sounds like a relatively normal date for a courting couple, according to Josh, it was far from that. The relationship was already on the rocks, and Josh alleged Nikki was attempting to control aspects of his life. At some point in the day, they had returned to Nikki's house on Middlewood, and after hanging out there for a while, they agreed that they were going to go to dinner. So they got ready, showers, changed clothes. Nikki had to run a couple errands. And sometime around 8 o'clock, they went to a pretty nice steakhouse in West Fort Worth. There they had a few drinks and dinner. And of course it was on Nikki's dime. That's one of the other interesting facts about this story. We've got the 20 year age gap, and we've got what appears to be a significant socioeconomic gap. Nikki seemed to pay for everything, and we're going to talk about some more of that later. But after they finished eating, they returned to her house at around 9:50 that evening. His story took a very strange turn when they got home. In his first interview with Detective Pate. In his first interview, Josh told Detective Pate that he was going to stay the night at Nikki's house. He stated that after preparing to go to sleep, he emerged from the bedroom to see Nikki wearing a bra, panties, and high heels. A little rendezvous took place on the couch in the great room, according to Josh. And afterwards, he went outside to smoke a cigarette. I believe this is probably the camera footage that the detective saw when somebody went out in and out after a relative short time. Josh told investigators or Detective Pate that smoking a cigarette angered Nikki and led to an argument. Because of the argument, Josh decided to leave for the evening and told her he was going to walk home. He told detectives he left the house between 10:30 and midnight and exited via the mudroom door. At the time, Josh lived in Benbrook, a small suburban city bordering or essentially surrounded by West Fort Worth. But regardless, it's probably a bit too far to walk from Nikki's house to his house. But that was his story.
Depending on where he lived in Benbrook, that's at least a 6-mile walk. Not exactly a short one indeed, particularly in the middle of the night. Josh also said he changed clothes before leaving, but lost the clothes he changed out of on the way home. He also said he had a .45 caliber handgun with him when he left the house, but also lost that on the way home. Red flags, all of these. But did detectives have enough to make an arrest at this point?
In my opinion, no. While the story was obviously strange, I still don't think it amounted to probable cause for the arrest, nor did the evidence at this point amount to probable cause for an arrest. When he was meeting with detectives on the first interview, begrudgingly, he consented to having a sample of his DNA taken. To me, this was another massive red flag. So he had the strange story, and then when Detective Pate asked if he could obtain a consensual sample of his DNA just by swabbing the inside of his mouth, Josh went back and forth, hesitated, paused, well within his rights to do that. No question about that. I mean, Detective Pate was asking for consent to do it. He didn't have a search warrant to do it. But I think you have to look at what's normal. To me, from the investigative perspective, if somebody is implying that I'm involved in a murder, like involved as the suspect, and I know that I'm not, I'm going to do everything that I possibly can to clear my name. So there's probably not going to be much hesitation on my part if a homicide detective asked me for a sample of my DNA while he's talking to me about a murder that I know I didn't commit. I'm going to do it without question. Take it, rule me out. That wasn't Josh, though. That wasn't him at all.
Josh, part of what we do is, you know, obviously we've been out there at that house for a while and processing that scene. And we collect evidence, we collect things, you know, at the scene. So a lot of what we do is prove not only what happened, but what didn't happen. And sometimes one of the ways we can do it is with DNA. Now, obviously, there's reasons for your DNA to be at that house, okay? But, you know, I was asking you specific questions about specific doors earlier because I think that whoever did this might have come through one certain door or another. Mm-hmm. And if I process that door and get what's called a mixture of DNA, then I can eliminate whoever's been there if I have a sample of their DNA. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So those are some of the things that we do sometimes. And I would like to get a sample of your DNA to compare with anything that I may or may not find there.
Okay.
Okay. You don't have to submit to this. This is what's called a consent form. And I'll read it to you, and you tell me if this is something that you're interested in doing or not, okay? Okay. I would fill your name in. It would say, I, Joshua Henry, have been informed by Detective Pate of my constitutional right not to have an intrusion made into my body for the purpose of conducting a buccal cheek test, blood test, or hair comparison. I'm going to pause right there. I ain't taking your hair. I ain't taking your blood. I would just want to swab your cheek only. But this talks about all three. But just know that I would only be taking a buccal sample of your cheek, which is a swab of your cheek. Knowing of my lawful right to refuse to consent to such an intrusion, I willingly give my permission to any qualified person to make such intrusion and withdraw sufficient quantity of my buccal cheek cells and our blood or hair with which to perform any necessary analysis. I give this permission for a buccal cheek test and our blood or hair test to the above officer voluntarily and without any threats or promises of any kind. If that's something that you're willing to do, I would ask you to sign this form. I'd put your name up here and get you to sign right there.
Who all else has done this?
Everyone I've talked to today, including children, including close family members, including everyone that I've talked to.
I don't know, man. I just have a really weird feeling about this. Like, the whole thing, the whole situation. Like, I don't understand.
Well, did you understand the way I said it?
I understand what you said, man. I just...
And I'm not trying to pressure you, dude.
It's just tough to, you know, like, my whole thing is that I've sat here and told you what happened. I don't know, like, in and out the doors, like... Even if I touched all the doors, what is that going to...
Here's the thing. We both sat at this table, right? Okay? Your DNA's on this table. My DNA's on this table. Mm-hmm. So we take a swab of this table. We get what's called a mixture of DNA. It doesn't just come back with one person's DNA. It comes back as a mixture. Okay? And so then you are asked, have you ever touched that table? And you say, yeah, man, I've touched that table. Hell, I had sex on that table. You know, whatever. I was there. I've been there. I've been there multiple times. I've been there. And then they ask me, and they're like, have you ever touched that table? I said, I don't know what table you're talking about. My denials hem me up later. But I can't tell whose DNA is which one. I can't tell if it's your DNA or my DNA if I don't have a sample of the knowns to extract. Okay? So if I have two...
samples of DNA, and I have a known sample, and I take all the knowns out, and then I'm left with one sample. And then I have something to put into a database where I can find an offender, where I can match to a bad guy, or something like that.
I get that.
That's what I'm trying to do.
I've just been set up for so many different things, and I've had to trust authority so many different times, and they've turned and lied to me and screwed me.
Okay. Well, I'm telling you, all I'm doing is trying to get the truth.
Well, yeah, it's fine. And it's like I was there. My DNA's there. I'm not denying that.
Okay. Well, would you sign this consent form for me to have your DNA, a sample of your DNA, to compare with any evidence I might find?
There's not my DNA not already in file?
Not that I know of, not with me.
But you can pull it?
Have you been
dealt with the court and all kinds of stuff and the CPS?
The only DNA that I have access to that's on file is what's called offenders. Have you ever been to a prison?
No, sir.
For an extended period of time for a felony or more?
No, sir.
And when they take those, when those people get out of prison, then they take their DNA. That's the only thing I have access to. I don't have any access to any social courts or stuff like that.
Sure.
We'll just sign right there and I'll fill in the rest.
Would it be better to say if I had an attorney?
Not to me.
Does it matter? I mean, what is it? What's the difference? I just don't understand. Like,
I can't make it. It's a yes or no question, man.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to.
And I understand, but I'm trying to simplify it. Okay. And I'm not trying to press you in any way.
In the interviews, it shows his hesitation in doing that. I do think that his response, his reaction to this question, that hesitation that he had, more than likely raised some more red flags to Detective Pate and Detective Cedillo, who were in the interview room with him. The one thing it did, though, it was another interesting part. The hesitation had another part of interest in my opinion, or at least my background. And it kind of reminded me of the tactic used in there's two schools of thoughts on, or really two primary types of interrogation tactics that the police use. And one of them, you may talk about a polygraph examination. So to ask a suspect to take a polygraph examination, it's not uncommon. The point of the question, though, is not always whether if the suspect will or will not take it. The point of the question centers around the suspect's response. So, for example, if I were going to ask you about a theft you knew you had nothing to do with, and I asked you, John, if you were to take a polygraph examination, and I asked you, did you steal the money, what would the polygraph examination results show?
No.
Exactly. Clear and convincing no. The guilty, or the suspect, I should say, it's always an excuse. Ah, I don't know. I don't trust those. You know, those aren't admissible in court. I've taken one before and I failed it. It's never that clear and convincing answer, or seldom is that clear and convincing answer. So again, going back to that polygraph question, that DNA sample, like I said, I mean, obviously the DNA in this case is going to be important. And I don't think that the tactic or him asking for the consent to obtain the DNA was just to measure his response. I think he had clearly had a legitimate need for it. But like I said, it did kind of remind me of that technique, because the clear and convincing answers are what the police want to see. the innocent typically will scream from the mountaintops their innocence. Not something we saw here. Definitely not something we saw in the first one, the first interview, that is. Going back to your question about did they have enough to make an arrest at this point? Yes, he admitted to going home with Nikki, to being at the scene of the crime. He admitted to leaving the house via the mudroom door. He admitted to arguing with Nikki. However, he never admitted to shooting her, but he continued to provide investigators with more odd statements, as you noted. I mean, he admitted to losing his clothes. Then he drops the other interesting tidbit, I thought, when he was confronted about owning a firearm. He tells detectives he may or may not have taken it, his Glock 45 pistol with him. Said, oh, it's either in Nikki's Escalade in the glove box, or maybe it was in the brown paper bag that I carried. I can't remember. The caliber in this case, or in his first interview with detectives, was important because he continually brought up a 45 caliber weapon when detectives knew that there were spent shell casings inside the house and likely the bullets that killed Nikki were 40 caliber, shell casings.
Detective Pate also asked Josh about his cell phone, which Josh said he also threw away in the woods because he was upset. The detectives release Josh, and Pate returns to the crime scene, which he leaves at 4:15 a.m. He is back at it at 10:15 the next morning. One task completed that morning is a visit to the steakhouse Nikki and Josh went to on the night of the 29th. The restaurant's manager is able to provide Pate with an itemized receipt and other records that indicated the two closed the tab at 9:29 p.m. Josh is asked to return to police quarters on January 2nd, and he abides.
He did. And this offers another Hollywood-type example. Remember, the detectives didn't call him and say, hey, we have a warrant for your arrest. They didn't force him to come up there. They simply called and said, hey, Josh, can you come up here again? We have some details that we need to clear up. Tom Segura, legendary funny man, stand-up comedian, talks about this exact scenario in one of his stand-up skits when he talks about the first 48, going back to the first 48 again.
Mm-hmm.
In the act, in his joke, he jokes about suspects that talk with the cops using probably the exact same mentality that Josh Henry used. Yeah, I'm just going to go talk to the cops and get this whole thing straightened out. I can probably convince them to the contrary that I had nothing to do with it. Thank God for the cops that crooks have this mentality, because it very seldom works. They rehearse it, I assume, what they're going to say. They rehearse these responses. And then when you walk in that 8x8 room and get confronted, they typically fold. So fortunately for detectives in this case, Josh thought, hey, I'm going to outsmart them. I'm going to convince them that it wasn't me. So in the second interview, Josh shows up. He initially draws a sketch of the house and notes where the cameras are located. He further tells Detective Pate that Nikki told him to schedule an appointment with some kind of audiovisual guy because she believed her ex-husband was stealing from her. So she had relayed to him at some point that she wanted to add cameras on the inside of the house. There was already, I believe Josh pointed out, 3 cameras on the exterior, but she wanted to add some to the interior. Josh wasn't for sure if that ever happened, but what did happen was he became somewhat familiar with the security system, because when the audiovisual tech person, I don't know what you would refer to him as, shows up, he has to have Josh help him. And so because of this, Josh had an idea where the breaker boxes were that controlled the security system, had a very, very basic understanding of it. One thing he wasn't sure, though, he was not aware of how to turn the security system off, or at least that's what he told Detective Pate in a second interview. Josh did point out that the house had multiple breaker boxes. He thought one was in the audiovisual closet and one in the garage. When Detective Pate asked Josh if a person shuts off a breaker box in the garage or AV closet, would it shut down the system?
What did he do to shut everything down?
He just unplugged a bunch of different things.
So is that how you would shut that system down if you wanted to?
I have no clue.
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
I have no clue how to shut it down. As far as I know, it can keep running off battery.
And that was my next question. If someone shut it down, would it run off of a battery?
As far as I know, I think it would.
So it may have a battery backup?
I'm not sure, though.
So after they talk about the security system at the house, Josh draws the sketch. They go over the timeline again. They went over the timeline from the time they left dinner, their $400 dinner, on Nikki's dime, of course, until they got back to the house on Middlewood. One thing he did change his tune about from the first interview. When they were inside the restaurant, in the first interview, he mentioned something about three guys sitting in a booth behind him, and they reeked of weed. And in the first interview, he said that this seemed to bother Nikki and she wanted to move because of the weed smell. So they did. Second interview, though. Now, the smell of weed is not bothering Nikki. In fact, she tells Josh, according to Josh, hey, go back inside there and see if we can score some weed. Josh tries, swing and a miss. They don't want to sell to the guy for whatever reason. So they leave the restaurant. And this is where some things, in my opinion, they're just my opinion, really start to stand out about Josh specifically. So as they're driving home, he tells Detective Pate that they were being followed by a black avalanche. So he's got that, he's paranoid for whatever reason. So when they get back to the house, he stays with pretty much the same story that he told Detective Pate the first time. He went in to get ready for bed. He comes out of the bedroom, the bathroom. She's there, very little clothes on. They have sex. He goes outside. He smokes a cigarette, comes back inside. She gets pissed off at him, and he leaves. And he always talks about this paper sack next to the door. What he described was the relationship was so volatile that he always had to have this exit strategy, that he always had to have his belongings by the door ready to go.
He's the victim in this thing, right? Is what he's trying to get at.
100%. He's trying to flip the script saying, hey, I'm not a bad guy. It's so bad. I have to keep a bag of clothes next to the front door. So when she starts in on her tirade, I can grab it and go. So that's what he tells Detective Pate. Hey, she got mad. It's the same old, same old. So I'm leaving. So when he leaves, he describes to Detective Pate that he was frustrated and he threw his phone, his cell phone. He also describes what else was in the paper sack that he took with him. He said he had clothes, and he made one comment I found interesting. He said he had clothes and a 19. Now, the firearm Glock was brought up several times throughout this case. Typically, when you in the gun world, I'm not a gun guru by any stretch of the imagination, but when I hear the term 19 as it relates to firearms, I typically think of a Glock 19, a 9mm Glock. He quickly corrects that statement, though, from saying a 19 to a Glock 45. Now, people can get the models mixed up. I don't know that that has any true significance. It just kind of stood out. I found that part kind of interesting that he brought up a different gun than the 45 that he had brought up earlier. But after bringing up the gun, he also makes sure to remind Detective Pate, I don't know if the gun was in the bag. Could still be in Nikki's glove box. I just don't know, which I think is pretty suspicious. I think most of the time, most people know, yes, I have a gun in my bag. I don't think that's something he's going to forget about. So the other thing that I noticed he hesitated to commit to answers. A lot of I don't remembers or I don't know kind of responses. Not usually clear and convincing responses.
I got a question, man. Am I a suspect here?
Dude, as far as I know, everybody's a suspect. I don't know who did this. I am trying to eliminate everyone, person by person, step by step. Now I'm just trying to figure out which way you went and go from there.
And that's fine. I want to know who did it too. I'm just, you know, this is just...
Who
else has been here?
There's been a lot of people here. But I'll tell you this. I haven't told anyone that you've been here. And I'm not going to tell you anyone that else that has been here. But okay. I'll tell you there's been a lot of people here.
Okay. If you only knew half of the story of me continuously being set up for something.
I've been told that a lot.
I'm not... Okay. I'm not trying to... I'm trying to cooperate and give you everything I got, man.
We're just asking you a few questions.
I know, man. It's just a little nerve-wracking.
Now, the dude would go on some diatribes about a bunch of trivial facts that had zero relevance to the case, but his answers, when confronted with direct questions, I think he skirted around him a lot. That was kind of his tactic. One of the other things he brought, obviously we know that the cause of death was from a gunshot. Detective Pate or Detective City, I don't recall which one, asked him about other guns that he had. He admitted to buying 2 9mm and 2 45s. He also mentioned something about a 1911, another 45 caliber pistol, but no mention of a 40 caliber pistol. So after a short break, and at about 2:29 p.m., a short break in the interview, that is, Detective Pate returns and confronts Josh.